is I did to change to a Blackboard talk because I thought after lunch it's perhaps more dynamical and keep the discussion going. So this is more or less what I'm going to try to cover, but please interrupt me at any point, ask questions and discuss. I think that's the goal of it being a Blackboard talk. So I'm going to talk about some work that I did together with Thomas Hugle, who's a PhD student in Heidelberg, as me, and Jörg Jekyll, who's my supervisor, and essentially is based in these two papers. I'm going to be talking about, so the title is A Non-Minimal Perspective on the Misalignment Mechanism. So I'm going to be talking about light-dark matter and non-minimal couplings to gravity and what that means for the production of dark matter. This is more or less the outline of the talk, and I'm going to start with some motivation. So yeah, let's start with that. So I guess the motivation to be talking about dark matter is the fact that we observe dark matter in the universe. We don't have a compelling model, particle physics model to explain what it is, but we have by now accumulated a lot of evidence in favor of it. So we have, for instance, observations of the dynamics of galaxy clusters, galaxy rotation curves, the CMB, structure formation, so a lot of things. But the bottom line is that the all evidence that we have for dark matter is gravitational, purely gravitational. And I guess this is the main observation or main motivation to be discussing what I'm doing, because in fact we have strong strong bounds on the size or on this on the strength of all other kinds of interactions that dark matter could have with the visible sector and also with itself. So at some point it's a good question, I think, to ask whether dark matter or the existence of dark matter might be due to us not understanding gravity at some large scales in the universe. This is something that people have tried to do with models of modified gravity. But I think it's a very interesting perspective, but I still think that the fact that all the observations that we have for dark matter points towards it being some kind of pressureless fluid, so some very weakly, probably very weakly interacting particle, motivates the fact that we want to still be in the particle perspective. So I will always be talking about particle dark matter, but I will allow for some wiggle room in terms of what we mean by gravitational interactions. And I think that's what's going to be the main interest of the talk. As I was saying, the first ideas when people were discussing dark matter was thermal dark matter, the idea that dark matter could be produced in the early universe if it has strong interactions enough with the visible sector. It would produce some abundance by the usual freeze-out mechanism, for instance, and this is what we're seeing today, right? And the idea is that, well, if it interacted with the visible sector in the early universe, it must also does it today. So you set up a direct detection experiment and try to detect dark matter. So this has been done, and very strong bounds actually have been put on the interaction cross-section of the dark matter because we haven't been able to detect the dark matter. So at this point, it's a natural thing to ask whether this more simplistic idea that we had could have been indeed too simplistic, and people have been thinking, well, what happens if the dark sector is actually more complicated than we thought? It might have some dynamics, the same one as the visible sector, has all kind of complicated dynamics that would make perhaps direct detection experiments less sensitive. And the other way to think, I would say, is to try to think or study what happens if dark matter is very weakly interacting. So if the interactions of dark matter are very weak, then perhaps it happens that dark matter was never in thermal equilibrium with the visible sector. And this means that we have to think about other production mechanisms which don't rely in this thermal freeze-out, and this points towards non-thermal production mechanisms for dark matter. Right, so this is something that, of course, has been studied for a long time, and probably the most paradigmatic example is the case of axions or axion-like particles, which are produced typically through the misalignment mechanism. I will discuss a bit later what are the details of the misalignment mechanism, but this is just to say that even if dark matter is very weakly interacting, perhaps only gravitationally, there are ways to produce it. The other thing is to say what we mean by gravitational interactions. Well, by gravitational interactions, we usually mean Einstein gravity, which if we formulate in a Lagrangian perspective, means just having this action. Here G is the metric, and then we have this term, which is usually called the minimal coupling, the Planck mass times the Ricci scalar, and then we just add whatever Lagrangian that we have for our particle physics model. Here I will be, for instance, setting the example of just some Lagrangian for some scalar field. And if we have this axiom, then we recover Einstein gravity. This means that we have the usual Einstein equations. Right, so this is the picture that we have, and the one that seems to reproduce all the observables. But there might actually be more things to it that are worth exploring. The first thing, perhaps, is to think, well, the same way that we do in particle physics, in effective field theories perspectives, when we say, well, any operator that could be that we could write in our Lagrangian, we should, in principle, explore and write it there, we could do something similar for gravity, right? So we could do some kind of effective field theory of gravity, or effective field theory approach to gravity, where we actually add all the possible terms with which we can build out of gauge invariant operators. For instance, we know that R is a gauge invariant operator, a diffeomorphism invariant operator, which is the gauge invariance of gravity, but there are other things. We could think of adding higher curvature invariants like Ricci squared or R mu nu, and things like that. And this is what usually people call modified gravity. But we can also think about adding direct terms which have both bits with with curvature invariants and also operators build up or out of the matter content of our theory, right? So something that we could write, for instance, something like this. So if we assume, for instance, that the field has a C2 symmetry if it's a scalar, or a U1 if it's a vector, we could also write things like that. Etc. These are just some of the examples that we could think of adding to the Lagrangian just because they are allowed by your symmetries. Another motivation is the fact that if we have, for instance, just say a free scalar theory that we want to quantize in a classically curved spacetime, we actually need to add some of these terms to the Lagrangian in order to be able to regularize the stress energy tensor properly. So I'm just going to say, quantization of the theory in classical curved background. And it is actually well known that we need to add some of these terms if we want to have a finite expression for the stress energy tensor in the theory. So this is another motivation for us to consider these kind of terms. And finally, in some approaches to quantum gravity, these terms arise there. For instance, in perturbative approaches like asymptotic safety, and perhaps some other points of view. So this is the motivation that I will try to, that I will use in order to say that perhaps instead of just having this Einstein gravity, this most minimal expression of how the scalar field interacts with gravity, we could think of actually allowing for these kind of terms, studying what are the phenomenological consequences for that. And so the fact that dark matter is only, or we think that dark matter might be very weakly interacting in other ways, in ways other than gravity, actually makes it a good target in order to test this kind of modification, just because the fact that it's very weakly interacting makes it more sensitive to these kind of couplings. So this essentially sets the stage or brings the goal that I want to be discussing, and is to discuss the effect of these kinds of, generalized interactions in the dynamics of light coherent dark matter, which is what I'm going to be discussing next, what I mean by light coherent dark matter. If there's any question or anything, please interrupt me at any point. So light dark matter, or I should say very light, this is the idea that if dark matter is composed by some state of very light bosons, then in order to meet the requirement of the necessary energy density, we need to have many of these very light bosons, which leads to very high occupation numbers. And the fact that we have very high occupation numbers actually simplifies the study of their behavior, because we can treat these light bosonic fields as classical fields. Right, so all we need to do to study the behavior and to understand how these fields behave in a cosmological setup is just solve their classical equations of motion. Which, in the limit in which the fields are homogeneous, are the following ones. For a scalar in an expanding universe, so in an FRW background, we have this very well-known equation of motion. And the other kind of bosons that we could think of having are vector bosons, which similarly actually have the very same equation of motion after we rescale the field in an appropriate way. So these are, of course, very well known and very well studied. These are just the equation of motion of a harmonic oscillator an oscillator in a harmonic potential.
How do you rescale the vector to get to that equation?
Sorry?
How do you rescale the vector? Because the vector, when you are over damped, still the energy density dilutes. So it's not the same equation.
Well, because I've written here chi, and chi is actually x over a. So this is the reason why it still dilutes, because there's this rescaling. Where the and when we compute the energy density of the vector, just because we have k squared over
what is
a.
The index, what happens to the index?
So
a vector index.
Yes, there should be a vector index here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is okay. So this is the equation. Okay. Good.
Yes. So this is just a nice rescaling, so that the dynamics of the vector field are actually exactly the same in this frame, except for the fact that you say that the energy density, will be different to the case of the scalar. But the bottom line is that when these fields are oscillating harmonically in the potential, we can solve this equation of motion essentially and compute the energy density stored in the fields. And we see that the energy density scale in both cases as a to the minus 3 when the field is oscillating in the minimum of the potential. So the fact that what you were saying is that when the field is overdamped, the difference is that the energy density of the field written in terms of this has an extra factor of 1 over a. But when it's oscillating, the energy density of both goes with a to the minus 3, which is exactly what we would expect, or what the scaling, the fact that cold dark matter or just some pressureless fluids just dilutes when the universe expands, right? So this is telling us that these kind of fields are very cold dark matter candidates. And this is the reason why we can treat them as dark matter candidates. Okay, so this is how it works. Now, what we want to discuss next is how they are produced, essentially, the essentials of the misalignment mechanism. I think I'm going to go over here because there, otherwise it will be too low. So the misalignment mechanism. So the only thing that we actually need to do, well, from now on, I'm going to be talking about scalars just to have some concrete example. But all the conclusions that we will reach will apply for vectors, mostly unchanged. And if you're interested to discuss where these small differences are, we can discuss later at any point. So for scalars, we just need to be looking at this equation of motion to understand how the misalignment mechanism works. So as we said, this is the equation of motion of a damped harmonic oscillator. So we have two scales in the problem. Essentially, the first one is the mass. Let me use perhaps colors because that would be useful later. We have the mass, which is setting the frequency of the oscillations. And we have the Hubble scale, which is the expansion rate, which is setting the friction of the oscillator, right? So depending on which one of those wins, we will be in different regimes of the harmonic oscillator. So we could try to plot here these two scales as a factor or as a function of the scale factor A, so cosmological time. So let's say that here we have inflation, here we have radiation domination, matter domination, all the different eras in the evolution of the universe. So the first thing that we can write is the mass of the field, which is the frequency of the oscillations. And we're talking about very light bosons. So in principle, we're talking about masses below or around 1 eV, which means that typically this is some very small constant, but it's something that is constant during the evolution of the universe. On the other hand, we have the Hubble scale, h, which we know today is very small, but it was much larger in the early universe, of course, depending on the scale of inflation. But typically, h during inflation will be larger than the mass and will be constant in order to have an exponential expansion. But then during radiation domination and matter domination, we know that it's a monotonically decreasing function of time. So it goes down like this. The point being that there's a time here where h becomes smaller than m. So this is going to be relevant. So let's study what happens here in this regime where h, the friction is much larger than m. This is just an overdamped harmonic oscillator. So the only thing that happens is that the field is just stuck at its initial field value. So this is overdamped. But then after this crossing happens, the mass or the frequency is larger than the friction, which means that the field will start performing the oscillations around the minimum and acquire the equation of state of dark matter, this dilution. So this is essentially just the misalignment mechanism. We have some whatever initial condition for the field value to be sitting at phi zero. It will be stuck there until the expansion becomes smaller than its mass, at which point it will start oscillating and behave like dark matter. So this is a quite simple picture. And it's actually very easy also to compute what the energy density or the Rayleigh density of this field is. And we can compute it and compare it with the observed cold dark matter energy density. And this scales roughly as whatever initial condition we have. And I'm going to plug some numbers and the square root of the mass. So this is the energy density of the field today. Roughly for a mass of 1 eV, we need an initial condition of 10 to the 11 GeV. And for smaller masses, we need larger initial conditions. So this is essentially how the misalignment mechanism works. And of course, this is so far we have only been discussing the homogeneous component. So this is just the homogeneous component of the fields. But in cosmology, we have to really be careful about fluctuations, not only the overall density. So this is the next thing that becomes important is what happens with fluctuations in this scenario. Well, in the usual scenario of Big Bang cosmology, what we think happens for the density fluctuations of baryons and photons is that these particles are produced from the decay of the inflaton. So all the density fluctuations, the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton, which are enlarged during inflation, are transmitted to these particles. And they generate what we know as adiabatic fluctuations, which is just to say that the quantum fluctuations of all the components are proportional to each other. So let me give you an example here. If we write if we give an example, for instance, of some spatial direction, and then the fluctuations in the energy density, the relative fluctuations of the energy density of different components, what we will have is that, so over the background density, we will have some spectrum of fluctuations, whatever we have, an over density, and then some under density, something like that, for instance, photons. And other components, like baryons, will have exactly the same spectrum. Perhaps a different amplitude, but the same spectrum.
Guys, what here?
This should be just an x. So this is whatever spatial direction. This is just to illustrate the fact that adiabatic fluctuations have the same spectrum for all the components of the universe. And this is because they're all originating from the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton. But now we have another field. The dark matter is not coming from the decay of the inflaton, but rather is some extra field which is present during inflation and, of course, has its own quantum fluctuations. And the picture that happens here is that now the fluctuations of this kind of dark matter are not adiabatic, but are actually isocurvature.
That's not necessarily true, right?
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Because you could have zero fluctuations in phi and generate dark matter fluctuations. Mm-hmm. I mean, the adiabatic fluctuations are communicated to phi.
Yes. The adiabatic.
So curvatures are not necessary.
Are not necessary, but are a general consequence of the field. If you have a very light field which is present during inflation, it will generally acquire this spectrum of fluctuations.
Yeah.
Of course, perhaps the amplitude is smaller or larger. But, and this I will discuss, but on top of these adiabatic fluctuations, the field can generally have some amount of isocurvature fluctuations. And the idea here, or at least the way that I have to see it, is that if we write the same, but for the, in this case, the dark matter, I'll get another color. Now, instead of having this same profile, they have some very different, an uncorrelated profile of fluctuations. So if the fluctuations in the dark matter are mostly isocurvature, which is not necessarily the case but can happen, what happens is that the overdensities of the dark matter and those of the rest of the fluids, like photons and baryons, don't necessarily match each other. And this is something that can be looked for in the CMB. And indeed, Planck has looked for this and has not observed the effects of these isocurvature components in the dark matter. So this means that the amount of density fluctuations in isocurvature with respect to those in adiabatic for the dark matter has to be smaller or equal than about 3%. At the scales at which we observe the CMB, which correspond to scales or of about 20 megaparsecs or so, so very large cosmological scales. So Planck is telling us that it seems that dark matter actually has mostly adiabatic fluctuations instead of isocurvature. And this is important for the misalignment mechanism, because there are some regimes where actually this protection mechanism produces more isocurvature fluctuations than adiabatic fluctuations. And do you see if I write here?
Oh, yeah.
OK. Because I'm going to just very briefly sketch what happens in terms of parameters for the misalignment mechanism. So if we have here the parameter space for the misalignment mechanism, which is usually just the mass of the field, and here the scale of inflation. So of course, the higher the inflationary scale is, the more fluctuations this field, the scalar field will have of its own, and the larger the isocurvature fluctuations are. So if we write here the mass in electron volts from 10 to the minus 22 to 1, for instance, and here the scale of inflation from 10 to the 14, so this is in GeV to, I don't know, wherever, 1 again, we see that this constraint by Planck actually puts a relatively strong constraint, which is perhaps not something like this, but which excludes this combination of parameters, which is to say that the misalignment mechanism is not compatible with high-scale inflation. The less so, the higher the mass of the field is. So this is just the usual picture. And the question is, well, is there any way around it? Is there any way in which one can reconcile the misalignment mechanism with high-scale inflation? So there is, and the way to do it, or one of the ways to do it, is to suppress the amount of fluctuations, of course, that the field has during inflation. And this can happen, for instance, if the field is very heavy. So instead of its mass being around 1 electron volt, its mass being closer to the Hubble scale during inflation. And this is something which will appear when we discuss the non-minimal couplings, which I'm going to move next. So is there any question about this? This is pretty standard, but it's going to be setting the stage. So then let me erase this. And talk a bit about non-minimal couplings. Or more concretely, what kind of non-minimal couplings are we going to discuss? So I will start just by writing the action that I'm going to be considering here for scalars. Is, well, here the usual one. Here we have the Planck mass, but now I'm going to be allowing for this kind of minimal couplings. That's one that we have before, perhaps the simplest one, phi squared r, and then just the usual Lagrangian for a massless free scalar. So this is kind of the simplest thing we can study for non-minimal couplings. We have this coupling, which is at least looking at it from this perspective, dimension 4, which means that xi is a coupling constant, a dimensionless coupling constant. It's allowed by symmetries, and as we were discussing before, it's motivated in different points by different reasonings regarding normalization of fields of the scalar theory in curved backgrounds and perhaps even quantum gravity. So this is the one for scalars. For vectors, we could write something similar. I said I was not going to discuss them, but there's some interesting points which we can see just by looking at the Lagrangian. So the equivalent for vectors would be something like this. And here just the usual field strength, and we can allow for Stueckelberg mass for the field of this kind. So this would be kind of the equivalent. I've chosen this normalization for vectors. And there's this difference in design here. And the reason why I've chosen this conventional design is just so this normalization and this design is just that it becomes.
Break the gauge symmetry.
Yeah, so this is what I was going to be discussing. This is interesting to discuss, right? Because the first question that arises, of course, is what happens to gauge invariants. This is not the gauge invariant operator. And that's a valid question, but this is not gauge invariant in the same way that, for instance, a Stueckelberg mass or a bare mass for the field is not gauge invariant. But we know that actually this is not spoiling the theory, so we can still construct a viable theory with this. So this is a fair question to ask, but there are ways to introduce this kind of non-minimal coupling.
How?
For instance, if you do some Higgs theory, and the Higgs, you can couple it non-minimally to gravity. And then the same way, if the BEF of the Higgs is proportional to R, then the vector will get this kind of mass term, which is proportional to R again.
Then you need some dissector Higgs, right?
Sorry?
Well, some dissector Higgs, not the standard model Higgs.
Yes, yes. So not the standard model Higgs, but just some scalar which gives mass to this.
So can you write the Lagrangian that you're considering?
So so this would be just the usual Higgs scenario with d mu phi squared. And then, for instance, we could write a potential for the Higgs, allowing for non-minimal couplings such that the BEF of the Higgs is proportional to R, right? We can engineer it with this.
What does that mean for a vector to be proportional to
R? So that the potential of the Higgs is minimized at some point, and the minimum of the potential is proportional to R, just because you can write non-minimal couplings for phi.
Sorry, this is not a canonically normalized field again, right? So you have phi squared R. This is again in the Jordan frame that you're thinking.
Yes, yes.
So can you work in the Einstein frame where everything is clear? How do you see it in the Einstein frame? Because now I don't even know how to go from the Jordan frame to the Einstein frame here because I have a vector field. So
the vector field is minimally coupled to gravity at this stage, so that doesn't have anything to do.
Okay.
Right, so this is how I'm generating this Lagrangian. So just a minimally coupled vector field, which then a Higgs, which is gauge, which has a gauge charge under this U1, for instance, and then the Higgs has, say, you can have couplings like phi squared R, things like that. Okay. And there you can go to the Einstein frame in the usual way,
okay,
with a conformal transformation. Yeah. This I will discuss later.
But then
what happens is that you can have in this way that the BEF of the Higgs, so you can write some quartic terms and then minimize the potential at a point which depends on R generally, right? It's the same way as the standard model Higgs, BEF depends on the mass.
Okay.
And then when you get this, the mass that you get here, of course, if you do this shift, for instance, plus phi tilde, which are the fluctuations, and this BEF depends on R, you will get the same way as you get the mass of the standard model mass for the vectors.
It's the BEF of R, the background.
Yes.
I'm confused. It doesn't make much sense. I mean, at quantum level, when you write that, that means something else. I can expand, and there's graviton interactions.
Yes, yes.
So the graviton interaction shouldn't be there. So because if I go to the Einstein frame, the vector field knows nothing about R.
Yes, if you go to the Einstein frame, then you won't have this kind of coupling. What you would have is some couplings between phi and whatever's sourcing R, right? So essentially, whatever dominant component, say, you have in the universe. If it's for instance, a cosmological constant, you will have a coupling to lambda. If it's a scalar field.
In that picture, how does the vector couple?
Well, in that picture, you get the same kind of couplings, but instead of having R, you have whatever value R has in terms of the stress energy tensor of the fluids that generate this component, of the fluids that dominate the expansion, for instance. So in the same way as here, if I assume that these fields are all subdominant, I would need to plug the exact value of R for each case, which is sourced by the inflaton or whatever.
The confusing part is if you go to the Einstein frame, you get factors of 1 over phi. in front of the kinetic term. So the field is no longer canonically normalized.
Yes, I agree.
So you cannot do the full equivalence the way you simply describe it right now. Right?
So you have to be careful, I agree definitely, and you have to check what transformation you have and in what limits it applies.
Yeah.
But so typically, so I wanted to discuss this later, but let's do it now. Typically, if you have, for instance, this kind of non-minimal couplings, what you do to need to go to the Einstein frame is to do a conformal transformation of the metric, right? This kind of transformation.
Yeah.
And this omega, or omega is omega squared is 1 plus or minus in this case psi phi squared over Planck mass squared. You get this kind of transformation. And of course, because there's a g here, this is going to be multiplying everything that you have, so making all the fields non-canonically normalized. But you need to, what you need to canonically normalize, as long as this is small, is a small deviation, which doesn't generate large couplings after the canonical normalization. So I agree that definitely you should be within the valid, within the range of applications of your theory. Essentially, as long as phi is way smaller than the Planck scale, then the modifications or the back reaction that you have in all the other fields are going to be negligible. So another way to see it, if you talk in terms, for instance, of fifth forces, because so these kind of terms, what generates is some kind of fifth force. All the forces that you generate, the strength compared to gravity, are always going to be suppressed by this factor. So the back reaction or the extra fifth forces that you're generating are always proportional. So their strength compared to the one of gravity are proportional to this, which means that as long as this is much smaller than one, you're going to be OK and not generate large back reaction into other fields, taking into account all the normalization of the fields and everything that you need to do. But well, I wanted to say that this is actually, there's this problem of gauge invariance, which I think it's not so severe. What is actually more severe is that if you look carefully here at this kind of Lagrangian, you get some ghost instability of the theory. And essentially, the reason why you get this is that this is inducing a negative mass for the scalar, actually for the longitudinal, for the vector, sorry, for the longitudinal mode of the vector. So yeah, it's not completely clear. It seems that this theory is actually sick because of this, but there might be ways to cure this instability. So this is just to say that I'm not going to be discussing the particular details of the UV completions perhaps of this model, but just look at the phenomenology. Although these theories might have serious problems, but I think it's something interesting to think about, and not necessarily the end of this theory. But okay, so this, in any case, I'm going to be discussing scalar fields. I just wanted to mention the case of the vectors because I think it's interesting also, not only from a phenomenological perspective, but for a more theoretical ones. Okay. And kind of this discussion brings me a bit to what I wanted to say next, is that about back reaction and the Jordan and Einstein frame. And as we've been discussing it a bit, I'm going to just skip what I was going to say and say that we can check by going into the Einstein frame that the back reaction, as long as this condition is satisfied, is going to be small. And the only important effects that will happen are at the level of the field phi itself, not on its back reaction to other fields, which means that the effect of this non-minimal coupling is actually to give an effective mass to the field. So now, again, focusing on the scalar field, the effective mass of the field is just going to be the sum of whatever mass term, bare mass term, we wrote there, plus this space-time dependent contribution, psi times r. And this is essentially what I'm going to be doing from now on, is looking at the phenomenology of what happens with fields that have this kind of space-time dependent mass. And I don't know how I'm doing with time. Quite bad. So let me just briefly sketch what happens if we have this mass in a cosmological background. So now I'm going to try to draw the effective mass of the field as a function of.
What is this ghost? You don't have to talk about this a lot, but what does this ghost look like if you try to write down like your Higgs model that you just.
Yeah. The thing that the problem comes about because if you write this Higgs model that I already sketched, you need a negative kinetic term for the Higgs to generate this positive mass. That's where the problem is coming from. But you can perhaps think about like some other different kind of completions, like Stueckelberg completions or other things. So this is something that I've been thinking about a bit, but I want to think a bit more.
How,
yeah, it's a good question.
Stueckelberg would help here?
Well, because if you, so if you do the Higgs way, then you see that you get this negative kinetic mass for the Higgs. But if you do some, like there might be other ways to generate this term, right? In principle, we know that we can just write down these kind of terms.
Yes, in principle, the Euclidean functions you can write down where you can explicitly with a B mu, with a three form, right?
Yes, and I was thinking perhaps if this apparent, because this the problem is that it generates a negative, kind of a negative mass, which makes the potential unbounded from below, but perhaps you could add so an x to the form terms that x stabilizes the potential or something like that. So I think it's something to think about, not necessarily the end of the story.
But the ghost is bad because the kinetic term is negative. It's not an instability, right? It's not the same as an instability.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The ghost is bad because it's negative energy, no?
Yes. No, what I'm going to think is that in principle, this theory has issues that one should need to really to think about a bit more carefully and in a bit more detail. I'm not saying that it's easy to solve for it or that it's actually solvable at all.
The scalar, which is fine.
Yeah. I'm going to be discussing the scalar now. Okay, so now again, we do a similar diagram. We have inflation, we have radiation domination, matter domination, lambda domination, whatever, and see what kind of contributions we have. The first one is just the bare mass. This is just a constant contribution. And the other one is psi times r. In an FRW background, r is something like like this. So omega here is the question of state of the expansion. So for instance, for inflation, omega is minus one. For radiation domination, omega is 1/3. And then matter domination, omega zero. And the domination, then again, minus one. But the point is that this proportionality factor is something like 12 during inflation. So this contribution to the mass here is in principle very large, depending on the scale of inflation, something like 12h or square root of 12h for the mass. But as soon as we go to radiation domination, we have 1/3. So this means that at the background level, at least, this r is zero during radiation domination.
You're assuming order one.
Yes, or the one xi. Yes. Yes, sorry. This is just for xi equals one, as an example. Yeah. So this means that as soon as we go into radiation domination, this is going to drop very quickly. At the background level, it would go to zero. But of course, we know that there are going to be fluctuations and other components, perhaps not being zero exactly. But the point is that this is going to be very small during radiation domination. And then matter domination, this is perhaps becoming larger. But we know that at the time of matter radiation equality, the Hubble scale is already 10 to the minus 28 electron volts, something like that. So it's tiny. The point being that the effect of this in cosmology, the effect of this non-minimal coupling is just basically giving the field a very large mass during inflation, but then it's essentially becoming irrelevant after that. And this is where what all the phenomenology is going to be based on.
Sorry. Shouldn't your this effective mass go to m5 during radiation domination because your r goes to zero? Because the second term is just the
yes. Yes, you go to m5. You go to this very light, the small late time mass. Yes.
So I guess maybe I misunderstood because it seems like you're saying that it goes below m5.
No, so these are the two contributions, and then the sum of those would be something like that.
Ah, I see. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah. So this is what's going to happen. Now I'm going to briefly discuss how this impact these production mechanisms. And for the first one, we already have it here, essentially the misalignment mechanism, and it's very easy to see what's going to happen. Now, the mass of the field is not going to be constant during inflation, but actually is going to be of the size of the friction, which means that instead of being overdamped during inflation, the field is going to be critically damped. So what it's going to do, it's going to slow roll towards the minimum of the potential. And essentially what happens is that the field value at the end of inflation is something like the field value at the initial the beginning of inflation times e to the minus psi times n, where psi is the coupling constant for the non-minimal coupling, and n is the number of e-folds of inflation. Right? So what's going to change at the end of the day is that during radiation domination, the oscillations will have a smaller amplitude. So this means that the energy density is going to be suppressed by a factor of e to the minus psi times n. Essentially, what this is telling us is that the...
Why is it linear in xi and not quadratic? The relaxation of fields will go like the mass to the fourth over Hubble squared, so...
Yes, but the effective mass, I've not written it here.
Mass squared is proportional to xi.
Yes, effective mass is m0 squared plus psi times r.
Yes.
So exactly. So what's going to happen here is that we have this exponential separation. So on the one hand, if psi is large, the product of psi times n is large, then this can give a huge suppression. And the point here is that n, the number of e-folds of inflation, we know observationally it should be at least around 60, but it could be much more. It could be a very large number. So even for small values of psi, suppression might be actually very relevant. To the point to which the dark matter yield of these scalar fields might be completely negligible, or if we turn the argument around, if we want this to be still holding, we have to make phi zero very, very large, so the pre-inflationary value. Perhaps to the point to which phi zero becomes larger than the Planck scale or close to the Planck scale, at which point we cannot say anything, but because we said that our approximations break down at this point, because we expect large back reactions or things like that. What's interesting in terms of the parameter space is that this suppression actually acts to diminish the isocurvature fluctuations, just because the field during inflation is now very heavy, so it's very hard for the quantum fluctuations to move it away from the minimum. So what happens here is that in this parameter space, the isocurvature bounds for positive values of the non-minimal coupling become weaker and weaker, move in that direction. So this is excluded by isocurvature for the different values of non-minimal couplings. Typically, these values are size of order 0.01. This could be 0.02, things like that, or of the order of 10 to the minus 2, the ones that become relevant. Something that we have to worry is that in this plot,
for xi of order 1, they're gone, what you're saying.
For xi of order 1, yeah, they could be gone. But something that's important is that we have this suppression. So in this plot, I am assuming that the field makes up all the dark matter. So I am fixing phi 0 as a function of m, just given this condition, which means that for values of xi, of large values of xi, and depending on the amount of inflation, we will run to this issue of phi zero being larger than the Planck scale. And so typically, this means that in this region, in regions roughly around there, we need trans-Planckian initial field value, which is something which we don't like. But bottom line is that even taking into account this thing, in any region below this line, we can choose a combination of non-minimal coupling and sub-Planckian initial field value with which we can generate the dark matter density. So this effect is actually making misalignment mechanism compatible with high-scale inflation. OK, and now there's two more things that I wanted to discuss, or if I have time, perhaps just One of them, the fluctuations one, because I think it's interesting. Let me perhaps use this space.
Listen, can you delete this second column here? Yes. Yeah, leave that so that we have some reference. Yeah.
Good.
I think everyone.
Good.
Yeah, the second. Yeah.
This one?
Yeah.
So the idea now for the fluctuations is, let's assume that the initial field value that we have, phi zero, is too small, and after this suppression, the field value of the end of inflation, which is, as we were saying, is phi zero e to the minus psi n, is just, well, too small to generate any amount of energy density. It's just tiny.
And then everything you do here, you're really always wanting, like, the plot that you've sketched and presumably is in one of these papers, you always take n to be the minimum.
So this is kind of the most conservative case of n equals n minimum, which depending on the scale of inflation changes a bit, but we could say it's order 60 or so for high scale inflation. Yeah. Of course, if you make n larger,
then
these lines become more and more dangerous for you. So having a large amount of inflation is not good for the misalignment. However, if this is too small, just because perhaps n is very large or xi is larger than you would expect, what you have is that the field during inflation is just relaxed to zero. But even in this case, we know that there are quantum fluctuations which are going to drive it away from zero. And the idea is that now the energy density is purely, or the field, the fluctuations of the field are larger than its average value. So it would look something like this, where this is zero. And if we translate this to, let me just use any different color, energy density, for which we need to square the field, what we get is something like that. Some contribution, which is always positive because we're squaring, and we're getting some energy density, yes, purely from fluctuations. And this is something that can happen if the initial field value is small or inflation is very large, and you can build up the dark matter purely out of density fluctuations. You might worry that actually these fluctuations we said are isocurvature, so we're making the dark matter purely with, it seems that we would be making the dark matter purely with isocurvature fluctuations, but the point is that these fluctuations, because the field is heavy, are only very large at small scales, meaning that the field is very hard to displace it away from the minimum over a large spatial region. And the picture is the following. Even if isocurvature fluctuations are large, I'm going to draw it here, what we get for the dark matter is that they are only large at small scales, but at large scales, it acquires the adiabatic fluctuation. So the picture would be something like this. Dark matter would be following, on large scales, the fluctuations of the photons, but have these small wiggles at small scales, which are the ones that are building up the energy density. So the way to actually see that is to compute the density power spectrum, which is just measuring the amplitude of the fluctuations at the different scales as a factor of k. And we see that this power spectrum is peaked at some small scale, k star, which is about 1 microparsec for a mass of 1 electron volt, and becomes larger for larger masses. And then, so if we plot this in units of k star of the peak, then we have a power spectrum that looks like this, where this is 1. This is a very small scale compared to the ones 20 megaparsecs where Planck puts constraints. So this, for instance, this would be the example of one EV, and then this would be the CMB scale, many orders of magnitude. So the bounds that Planck puts at these very large scales can actually be can be consistent with this picture just because there's a suppression of the fluctuations at large scales, which can be below the observable limit. So this would be something like 10 to the minus 10 or so, which are the Planck constraints. But we still get enough density because we have the large fluctuations at small scales. And this is the idea. I'm going to be very quick in saying that the requirements for this are three. One, we need large scale of inflation, because the larger the scale of inflation, the larger the fluctuations are. So we like HI, of course, below, but close to 10 to the 4 GeVs. We also need large masses of the field, about practically 1 electron volt. And we need non-minimal couplings, again, of order 10 to the minus 2. And then this becomes possible here. And let me see how I'm going.
You're doing fine.
OK. Because then I can perhaps discuss this stochastic regime, which is also quite interesting.
And the parametrically, right, the energy density that you get out of this is just whatever the mass of your field is in, like the radiation domination mass, m squared h squared.
M squared h squared. It's not exactly, there's not such a clean expression as this one, but it depends on the mass, so it becomes larger with larger mass and larger h, but there are other things that become important there.
How does it scale? I guess this is what you're asking.
Yes.
How does it scale the speed with fundamental parameters?
So the peak of the spectrum, the position of the peak depends on one. You mean the amplitude?
Yeah, both.
So the amplitude, what we're doing is, we want this to be dark matter. So we set the constraint that if we integrate this power spectrum, we get the observed dark matter abundance, right? So that's what's setting it. But if you compute on what this dark matter abundance depends, you get something like, proportional to m squared times h I squared. But you also get some other dependencies that depend on the evolution, the cosmological evolution of the field. So
What?
So this is typically order one, the peak.
So this is the dimensionless power spectrum you're
using
here?
Yes.
And this is at the time of?
This is at late times, meaning at times after the field is oscillating, so late enough so that h is smaller than the mass. This is the late times power spectrum. Because this suppression actually that happens at small scales relies on the fact that modes, which are very small scale modes, are sub-horizon are relativistic when they re-enter the horizon and they oscillate, and therefore they lose the amplitude. Because the primordial power spectrum is just going up towards smaller scales. But those are suppressed because of this effect, because they oscillate.
I don't understand. I mean, these things would, even though they're relativistic, they just oscillate.
Yes.
So if you have a primordial power spectrum of isocurvature that's already in the action field, why does it dissipate?
Sorry, say again. So the thing is that...
So these are isocurvature fluctuations,
yes.
Right? So that means these are fluctuations of the action field, and you don't need to imprint the adiabatic on the action.
Yes.
So why does it keep going up? Why is there suppression?
So the suppression is because, the condition for this mode actually, so this is the mode that becomes non-relativistic at the times it enters the horizon and at the same time that h equals m.
No, the thing that I'm wondering, so this you've evolved past matter radiation equality?
So this we have evolved late enough after this condition is satisfied.
It's still in radiation domination.
Yes. So there's plenty of time between this and matter radiation equality.
Then I don't understand why the other modes are not suppressed, because these are fluctuations of the field itself. So
yes.
These just oscillate.
Yes, but they oscillate with a damped amplitude.
Why is that?
The energy density in those modes, because radiation is damped as a to the minus 4. The energy density in those modes with respect to the one of the fields which are frozen, for instance.
These are not modes that are imprinted in phi, not in radiation.
Yes, they're phi, but they are relativistic modes, so they behave as radiation.
Okay.
So when they enter the horizon, these modes are relativistic, meaning that k is larger than their mass, right? This is comoving, so k times a is larger than the mass, I think, is the condition. And therefore, they oscillate with damped amplitude. The same as radiation. So the equation I was writing before was for the homogeneous field, right? But you could write the equation with k.
Yeah, if you write the equation with
k. So for those modes, basically, you would get something like this. Right, neglecting the mass, supposing that the mass is much smaller. And this has the solution where phi is proportional to 1 over a.
I see.
But and this is how, well, the, here it should be meaning phi k.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you're saying.
The mode.
Okay.
So the thing is that this is the mode that's redshifted the least, the least because it's not, because it becomes relativistic when it enters the horizon. Yeah, so it never oscillates like this. And at the same time, it was produced late enough so that it was not super horizon during inflation, and this suppression was not so effective. So this is this interplay of two scales.
Can I ask my question about the total energy density again?
Yeah.
Sure, there's some like other factors that depend on cosmotic, but those are order one, right? At the end of the day.
Yes,
like
mostly.
N squared h squared is parametrically.
Yes, yes, yes. That's the bulk of the energy density. Yes. Yes.
So what shape does this power spectrum have, for k less than k star? Is it just?
You mean what's the spectral tilt? Yeah, this is something interesting. So essentially, n, I guess I could say isocurvature is something like 1 minus 1 plus. This is red tilt. Red tilted, so 1 plus 8 xi. So it depends on the non-minimal coupling. So this is something interesting because if you could measure this tilt at some point, then you could. So if you measured isocurvature modes and you saw that they have some red tilt, you could perhaps think about inferring something about the non-minimal coupling. Yeah, good question. Okay, any other question about this? If not, I mean, I think it's already 1 hour, but do I have time to discuss this? Good, then I will talk about the stochastic regime. I guess I can erase here. So the stochastic regime is based on the observation that if we have fluctuations in this case, which are very, very, very long wavelength, which have a wavelength larger than the current size of the universe, then we cannot distinguish those very large scale contributions from a truly homogeneous background. So the idea is that, again, some picture. If we have x, some spatial dimension, here we have phi, say our universe is this size, so has radius 1 over a0, but we have a fluctuation with a wavelength which is way larger than that, something like that. Then for any observer who lives in this universe, this just looks like a background field, a homogeneous field, right? So we could think of what happens if, the same as before, whatever truly initial condition we had is damped away, but these super horizon fluctuations contribute to a homogeneous field. And this is what I call the stochastic regime. The idea here is that the homogeneous background in its Hubble patch is not determined by the initial conditions, but it's rather picked randomly from some underlying distribution, which just depends on each patch of the universe, how much super Hubble fluctuations have accumulated. So for instance, for each wavelength that exits the horizon during inflation, we can have a positive contribution or a negative one. And in the end, they will all accumulate and generate a variance that sets the homogeneous field value. What I'm trying to say is that in this regime, the homogeneous field value is chosen randomly from a distribution which has whose variance, essentially, depends on the accumulated variance of all the modes which have of all the modes, so the variance of a single mode. So this is something like phi squared, and this is something like phi k squared for a single mode. And here we have to integrate over all the modes since the beginning of inflation. So whatever beginning of inflation is, till the size of the observable universe, A0 times H0. Right? So if we integrate over all these modes which exited the horizon during inflation before the observable modes exited, then we will have this stochastic contribution. And parametrically, if one does this integral, one gets that this variance is something like hi over the mass of the field squared. So this is something for which you don't really need no minimal couplings. But if you have a no minimal coupling and the mass of the field is set by the no minimal coupling itself during inflation, so something like square root of xi times hi, we see that this variance becomes just this, the Hubble scale over xi. This means that we can enhance this accumulated variance with respect to the one of a single mode whose amplitude is just hi squared. So this is something like hi squared over xi over hi squared. So this is 1 over xi. So this means the accumulated variance of the superhorizon modes is enhanced by a factor of 1 over xi, meaning that the smaller xi is, the larger this enhancement is. And the point here is also to do with isocurvature fluctuations, is that the power spectrum of isocurvature fluctuations essentially depends on the variance of the CMB mode over the energy density of the field, which is set actually by the accumulated variance, which is what set the homogeneous field. So this is proportional to xi. And we know, because of Planck, that this has to be smaller than 10 to the minus 10. So this is actually telling us that this scenario, this stochastic scenario, only works if xi is smaller than 10 to the minus 10 or so. But in this regime, we can build up all the energy density of the field just by accumulation of these super Hubble modes and no dependence on initial conditions. And so this is very.
So the reason you need the large mass is to evade the constraints from. So the reason that the mass has to be larger than 1 eV is because you want to avoid the constraints from isocurvature?
It's a combination of that together with the requirement that you need enough energy density. So larger masses help you to get more energy density. Because
phi naught gets damped out.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. So, but in here, the stochastic regime, it's slightly different. The thing is that you need to accumulate a variance which is much larger than the one of a single mode. And that's only possible if xi is small.
Mm-hmm.
Then I wanted to talk a bit about observables. So something we've already discussed is this component of isocurvature, right, which has a particular spectral index. So it's something that we could think about observing. For instance, with CMB stage 4, which is supposed to go to improve this limit by a factor of 5 or so. But I think what's interesting, perhaps even more, is the fact that we could try or we could think of ways or trying to find observable consequences of these large isocurvature fluctuations at larger scales. And this is, I think, something which could be interesting, perhaps, because it scales favorably in this direction. Another thing is the fact that we have a peak power spectrum here at very small scales, which means that we would expect these overdensities to collapse early on, perhaps matter radiation equality or earlier. So this is essentially telling us that dark matter is very clumpy already also in this scenario. The thing is that the physical size of these clumps would be something like, very naively, k to the minus 1 over c equality. This ends up being something like 10 to the 4 kilometers for a mass of 1 electron volt. But most importantly, the mass, if you just compute the mass enclosed in the horizon at this size, you find that the mass of these things are typically very small,
mm-hmm.
So 10 to the minus 25 eb over m to the 3/2. So if this is probably too small to be observable, I don't know, perhaps this don't even survive structure formation. But this could become relevant if you could make this work for larger masses somehow. Otherwise,
They do survive their turns, right? If you get order one, there's nothing, density is relevant for tidal disruption.
Okay.
How big you are.
So
I think they survive. Do they get, do I think anyone for direct detection is not clear? But those parameters, because they may be too dense.
It's very close.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same sort of thing that, like, in the Axion minicluster literature, they've collapsed. It's like a factor of, I don't know, 5 to 10 before matter radiation equality. And for those things, you don't hit.
No, but these are 12 orders of magnitude smaller. So
yes. Well, this is a very naive computation, right? Just collapsing at matter radiation equality, but
good.
I think it should be.
Good. Yeah. It's pretty good. That level of discussion.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
So I think it's probably too small for astrophysical observations, perhaps for direct detection and things.
You can check the parameters in our paper. I think it could be relevant for direct detection because these things can hit the Earth. They won't survive hitting the Earth, but they will survive long enough to hit the Earth if they're dense enough.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting.
So, but you are assuming,
What the other part of that is, it's truly they may hit the Earth frequently enough, but because you only have, like, it's not clear that order, like, most, the vast majority of the dark matter will be in these clumps, right?
Here they have a peak, it's still going to be order one, right?
Yeah, I think so.
It can be order one, but if there's also still order one in the background, then...
I wouldn't expect so, just because it's very clumpy at these scales.
To check the numbers, because they have a clearly peaked spectrum, even if it's 10%, I mean, it depends on the numbers, right? So you can actually evolve the spectrum and get some idea.
Yeah.
What fraction of that you have there.
That's of course something that would be interesting to do next. What happens this after nonlinear collapse? We stopped at the linear regime for this, but yeah.
Because order one, you're saying, has some very high redshift, right?
Yeah.
Over today, it's much larger than order one variance. Then it's right that most dark matter will be in these clumps.
Yeah.
I would expect that too. Yeah.
Even if it's but you have to run the numbers and see. I mean, I don't remember off the top of my head what we had in the paper.
No, but I will.
Observationally, astrophysically, don't do anything. But, for direct detection, maybe. The problem is that the model is a bit funny because it's not really an axion, right? It's a scalar.
So I agree that this is something. So this is a scalar field which you want to be very light, so you have the usual hierarchy problem. How do you protect the bare mass from being small?
We know hierarchy problems. I don't know.
Yeah.
We did them for 30 years.
Yes.
It is a problem, but I don't know if I can really analyze you for it. I don't know if you can see such small couplings, because in principle, this couples extremely weakly to standard model fields, right?
Yes. So. Yeah, you could have some other couplings. You would need them to be small.
Is it quadratic or is it linear? I think
this quadratic. We're dealing with the quadratic. If you have linear couplings, then it's very dangerous because you have strong back reaction because you don't have this suppression, this phi over m Planck suppression anymore. So you have strong fifth forces. So linear couplings to the curvature are quite dangerous.
With those masses.
Okay, with those masses, you might be okay. Yeah,
that's why I'm saying so those masses, when we're talking about now, well below a millimeter, right?
Mm-hmm. So that's true.
So you can be much stronger than gravity. You won't be as strong as ENM, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I think there the phenomenology might change a bit. This is not anymore a mass, but just...
That's true, actually. Yes, it's not a
mass. It's just like a runaway potential, kind of. So you would be, you could engineer this, for instance, if you have a contribution like that. Yeah, you could drive the field.
Term, right?
You could drive the field away from the minimum during inflation.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do probably some phenomenology with it, but it would be different to what to this.
But
but as you're saying, for such strong couplings, as you're saying, you would have constraints from force links to barriers, right?
So this is
not necessarily. I mean, you're hitting the physical bounds at some point. There's going to be a constraint from stellar production of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be much stronger than gravity for sure. So it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be 0.01.
Yeah, that's right. So the strength with respect to gravity here would just be xi. There would be no xi phi over m, but just xi.
Then you can't make it very large because the baryonic reaction becomes very large. So
yes.
This.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, your best bet because it's direct detection, but then the question is for the minimal couplings that you have. I mean, it would be interesting if you could measure the coupling also from the. This has an exact prediction about what the coupling to standard model particles is, right?
You mean in the Einstein frame? Yes, if you go to the Einstein frame, you will get couplings. I agree.
Sure. there you have a prediction of what the coupling is.
Yes, so the couplings that you would get is, so for instance, for mass terms, you would get couplings of order mass of the particle times.
Not mass squared.
Not mass squared, yeah. Mass, depending if it's fermions, times psi phi over, something like that. I think squared probably, things like that. And then, but you would get other things from kinetic terms and things like that. But I think this is the kind of the strength of the interactions that you're always playing with.
How big is the amplitude inside the clamps? Yeah, it's very small.
So I think. I don't know, perhaps one of the best bets would be to try to look for this isocurvature component at small scales.
Can you use it to... This will use a transient... How long... You can look for transient mass shifts in atoms.
Okay.
So you can look for... So these things may hit enough. You have to we can calculate the incidence rate. I don't want to get up on the board. What is the incidence rate on Earth? You know the mass, we know the local dark matter density.
Okay.
What is the rate of incidence on the Earth?
Okay, so I guess you would have. So the density of these things with respect to the overall one, so let me see.
Their
number density, right? N is the number density. Number density of the clumps.
Not inside the clump, but overall as an average.
So this would be something like, just rho over m cubed, right?
No.
Over m?
Yeah.
So rho is something like
g. 0.3 GV, half a proton per centimeter cubed.
Over 10 to the minus 25 solar masses, which 10 to the
57 dB. Sorry. One solar mass is 10
to the 30.
57 GV.
Yes. So 10 to the 30 kilos. So
10 to the 32 thereabouts. Yeah, 10 to the 32 GV.
Because, 32 GB?
Yeah, so now convert,
One over, this is centimeter cubed, right? So size of,
let's call it 10 to the minus 33 between ferns per centimeter cubed?
Yeah.
Okay.
But
so the rate of incidence on the Earth is what? How would you calculate?
What size are these things again?
He has a third. Oh.
Yeah,
10 to the 4 kilometers, so they're pretty big.
I mean, this is just their size at the time of turnover, right?
Yeah.
So this is the size at the time of collapse. So to say, they might collapse even further.
Why should they?
Yeah.
So then, what is the rate of incidence on the Earth.
So the rate of incidence in the Earth.
Yeah.
So you have.
That's their density.
Yeah. So then square L.
Okay, wait. Let's do it.
So I guess it would be something like so the size of the Earth.
You don't need the size of
the Earth. You care about the detector.
Just use n sigma v, where sigma is the area of your thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
V is the velocity of dot.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Sorry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I guess you just multiply A times sigma V,
yeah.
And then sigma is just L squared something.
Yeah.
In centimeters, yeah. So 10 to the
5, 10 to the 9,
mm-hmm,
this is
10 to 18, 18, 10 to the 18.
So this is 10 to the minus 33.
10 to the minus 15.
10 to the minus 18.
18?
Yeah, that's
correct. This was?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the velocity is what? The first is 10 minus 3, so this is 10 to the minus 18.
Yep.
So centimeters per second, I guess, was what you want.
Mm-hmm.
10 to the minus 18 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Per second.
No, wait.
What? No, that doesn't sound. No, sorry, that doesn't sound right.
Okay, so n was 10 to the minus 33.
Yeah.
Sigma, you said, was 10 to the 18. So, okay, so we have 10 to the minus 15.
Times 10 to the minus.
V.
Yeah.
10 to the minus 3, so real velocity.
Yeah.
So 10 to the minus 18, right?
Per centimeter.
It's per centimeters.
Per centimeter, yeah. Yeah.
No, guys. No, the units are off.
Well.
Sorry.
No, the 10 to the minus 3, yes. Yes, that's a problem. We have to put in the
that is right.
The 10 to the
seconds.
Yeah.
It's not over 1%.
It's 10 to.
Okay, so 10 minus 18 was n sigma. So V is 2 V in centimeters per second.
Yeah.
As opposed to C units.
I'm
not sure why people are doing it. so V is like 200 kilometers per second.
Mm-hmm.
So about 10 to the 5 for centimeters per second.
10 to the 5 centimeters per second.
Okay, so if we're 2 to the 7
so,
times 10 to the minus.
So this 10 to the minus 15 times.
10 to the 7.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, 2 to the 7. Yeah, so that's.
10 to the.
That's one per year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so you have one per year. So one per year, once per year, you go through, you have an atomic clock.
1 per second times 10 to the 5.
And then you compare two levels. This will change the electron mass, right?
Yes, any mass.
It will be as the thing moves over, because they are about 10 to the 6 times more dense than CDM,
mm-hmm.
Right? So you will change the amount of dark matter you have by
the thing is that you will this kind of conformally you change all this mass all the masses not only the electron ones right you change all of them proportional to the mass.
But if you have two different elements, the energy levels depend differently
on the mass.
On the masses,
yeah,
on
the
right?
Nucleus. Yeah.
So for example, if you were to compare a hyperfine splitting to an optical splitting,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're right that the mass cancels out and it don't care. But if you compare a hyperfine splitting to an optical splitting, then you get something. Now the problem is, I think the amplitude may be too small.
The amplitude of the field, I think you can express this in terms of the energy, well, of the density of these things over their mass to get the amplitude of the field. So this would be something like psi times rho of those things.
Yeah.
Rho of those things over, so rho is m squared phi squared, so over m squared Planck mass squared, something like that.
Yeah. That's very
so that would be your relative amplitude, yeah.
Yikes. Because it's 10 to minus 6 locally, 10 1 eV, it's like 1 eV cubed and 1 eV to the 4th divided by an eV. That's tiny.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, it's just this suppression, it's huge suppression.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying you should consider linear calculus. Those things are magnitude is very small today.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's thank you.
Thanks.
Anyway. Can you make it? I would consider linear, because it would be cool if you could measure xi from two in two different ways.
Yeah, I agree. So you can think of making linear, so another thing that I was trying to think
just two pi.
Okay. So xi times five, I mean you would have, I think what would happen there is as long as you have a mass, what would happen is that you would run away, but eventually the mass will pick up, so you would have some initial condition during inflation fixed by a combination of r and the bare mass of the field, the combination of the linear plus the quadratic terms.
Yeah.
I don't think that would necessarily give you this.
I don't know. I have no idea how it will go.
This kind of clamping. So this would, I mean, this linear term for me, I think what would just give you is like a way to construct some initial condition for the misaligned mechanism. So this would allow you to go to, I guess, probably larger initial field values or something like that. But I don't see why you should have this clamping.
I mean, you're
at least naively.
Slow rolling, right? I mean, if you have the same, I don't know how, I have no intuition how it will go for the rest of curvature stuff. But you shouldn't worry much about, the point is that if you consider such heavy masses, xi can be much larger than you think.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's the issue of the back reaction, right?
Yes.
But then you can have. If
probably
you
would have.
Linear in the coupling, that makes it so much better. You have no idea for so many things.
Yeah.
Because it's the square root of the amp, right?
Yes.
Because
I see.
You're comparing to something that has square times square.
Yeah. Something that I was thinking. Of course, you want to look for places where r is large, but today there are not so many places where r is large, because so you could think around black holes, but those are all really flat. So perhaps if you have some distribution of or a cloud which generates a large r of this very light bosons around the black hole, whatever, and those accumulate and generate a large r, what might happen is that these might become larger than their mass. So say you have an ultralight boson, you only need this to be larger than 10 to the minus 22.
Yeah.
And perhaps there you could have some impact. Yeah, it's something, again, I was thinking a bit. But it's not clear to me.
Once per year. That's human time scales.
Yeah.
Fallen in the sector, not the Earth, right? Many more fall on the Earth.
I mean, it's as big as the Earth. This is the size of the Earth.
The size L. 10 to the 4.
Yeah, so it's 10 to the 4 kilometers.
Yeah.
Oh, 10 to the 3 kilometers, sir.
Six times 10 to the 3. So they match the size.
Yeah, they're planet sized.
They're planet sized. Thank you so much, and I'm sorry.
You're welcome. It wasn't so hard. Yeah, sorry. Sorry for going a bit over time also.
I
was thinking of doing slides, but then I thought it would be nicer to be able to disguise.
Not,
I saw this blackboard and said.
It took you a while to go through the simple stuff first. That's the problem.
Yeah. But I didn't know, like, I thought it's usually good to introduce also for the people who don't know details.
No, but I agree. I actually liked it because we had time to, and I would like to see the things that I would like to see more is more of the details of the parametrics.
Mm-hmm.
You understand, how does the size of the peak, can you make this, is it always one here? Can you make it smaller?
Well, so what we care about is making all that matter, right? So you could think of relaxing that assumption and changing things a bit.
But the one is related to having all of the dark matter.
It's a combination of all the assumptions, of course, and that's one of them, that you want to have all the dark matter. That sets some relations between the parameters, right?
Yeah.
But this is general, that the fact that you get or the one, I think, doesn't really depend. What tells you is that you need large masses, essentially, and large scale, these large aids. And that's what matters for the radic abundance.
Yeah.
Any spectral index of these perturbations is like generically slightly blue, you're saying?
It's like, sorry?
It's slightly blue, you're saying?
It's slightly blue, yes, yes. This, yeah, I was thinking perhaps you could, I was thinking of whether having, for instance, large isocurvature fluctuations at small scales could give you somehow halos without dark matter or galaxies with less dark matter than you would expect. Because so this is very large scales, but if you go here at the scale of some small galaxies, perhaps you can, if you have large isocurvature, then the overdensities of the dark matter might be smaller, for instance, than what you expect to accompany one of the baryons. So you would have a galaxy with less dark matter than you would normally expect. So I was thinking if this, I mean, you could have some visible effects, for instance, for these galaxies that people say that they're discovering that have less dark matter, or some observation in that sense, right? Kind of a way to devoid some galaxies of dark matter.
We should use that as motivation.
But... no, it's not, but. A way to try to probe isocurvature at smaller scales than that of the CMB one.
Right. Related to that. One thing maybe you could look for is like spectral distortions in the CMB, because when you have lots of small scale power, the power damps into the CMB, producing the spectral distortion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's sensitive to the structure at k around 10 to the 4 or so.
Okay.
10 to the 4 in my units. So
these
are,
what are your units?
Megaparsecs.
Yeah, so this is a kind of microparsec scale the peak, but of course you don't need to go all the way to 1. You might be okay with having this size, right? This is the amplitude of the adiabatic ones, about 10 to the minus 10, so you don't need to go all the way to the peak to have large.
So we can almost detect, in the CDM, there's an expected amount of this spectral distortion coming from damping of the expected adiabatic mode.
Mm-hmm.
And so now if you have extra modes on top of that.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, would these extra structure maybe, enhance the spectral distortions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something I haven't looked into, but sounds plausible. Mm.
Well, okay, so it's 10 to the 4 in megaparsecs. So in your units, I guess it's 10 to the minus 8 relative to K star.
So 10 to the minus, 10 to the 4 megaparsecs, or, 10, sorry, I'm confused now. So, because, so this is like 20 megaparsecs or so, right? Where you can put bounds from the CMB. So the CMB, pivot scale.
So in the primary anisotropy,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But besides that, in the monopole of the CMB,
okay.
In the spectrum of the CMB,
mm-hmm.
okay, you can show that damping of very high K mm-hmm. modes, damping of those modes produces a spectral distortion
mm-hmm.
in the energy spectrum of the CMB.
Yeah.
And that we can measure pretty precisely.
Yes, but so what was the scale that you can get down to?
So the modes that get damped, whose energy then turns into a spectral distortion, that K is around 10 to the 4 in like normal CMB units, which is megaparsecs.
Yeah.
So in your units, which are microparsecs, I guess there's like a 10 to the 12th factor.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore,
it really depends on the exact position of this with respect to this peak, right? But,
KCMB normally is like 0.05.
Yeah.
So 0.05 versus 10 to the 4 is...
So inverse megaparsec, sure. Then I guess, this would be like 5 orders of magnitude.
Right.
So 5 orders of magnitude times this. Xi, so Xi is, could be like 0.1 or so, it times Xi.
So it's order 1, so...
And that over 4 or 5 decades. Yeah, you could have... like a 10% or so effect. I guess if this is 1%, the limit is 1%, and you go as high as you can.
But you would see that? this would be this is the scale that you the lens and stuff that you look at. What sorry, I'm
missing. This is smaller scale even than the lensing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this would be, I think this is something like 15 orders of magnitude or so for one MeV, and we would be looking at just a third, like a third in the weight, and to the five orders of magnitude higher k than the CMB one. So if you go, I mean, very naively, this is linear. So in one third, you go from minus 10 to zero. So this would be an enhancement of three orders of magnitude, right? The amplitude would be quite large already there. Yeah, I think.
Oh, no, wait, sorry, I don't understand. I mean, like, you know, a spectral index is, I mean, slightly more than one.
Mm-hmm.
And so normally the spectral index is slightly less than one. And so therefore the XX power is just the difference in that spectral index, right?
Mm-hmm.
Over that five orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
So the actual spectral index is like 0.96 or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And so here your C is, I mean, would you say like 0.1? Oh, well, okay, well, if it's 0.1, yeah, so then it's like order one change in the spectral index.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah, so then that would make a huge change in the power of 10 to the 4, which therefore could then make a huge spectral distortion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so perhaps you could put interesting
Gaussianities?
Yeah, that's also what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Do you get non-Gaussianities? Did you do the bispectrum for this?
Yes, actually, because you have to do the, well, not the bispectrum, but the trispectrum to get the energy density, but, so I would say you do get non-Gaussianities just because you have no background, right? So, I would expect so. Yeah, I didn't compute them.
So, do you expect non-Gaussians?
I'm just trying to think.
You should expect some.
I think so, yes.
Because this is coupling to the inflaton, right? I mean, if you go to the Einstein frame, this is coupling to the inflaton because phi dot gets a bear, so it should get. You should get non-Gaussianities.
Yeah, but
see, the thing is that that's the weird part about the Jordan frame. It doesn't stop.
No, but you do have a coupling. So but the coupling to the inflaton, again, is this thing. Is this?
Yeah, but the field is much larger during inflation.
Yes.
Right?
So the suppression is not so large.
Yeah, so the
you can be better
is
off.
Not so large, and I don't know how it may affect bigger scales because at the early times the field is bigger. And this is basically a kind of a massless field. So if the mass is close to inflation, you get like the cosmological collider stuff with oscillations.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yes,
but
I think
it may require much bigger couplings because here you have 1/n+2, but still you have very large coupling. I don't know. You have to check the coupling.
Yes.
It may be small actually because here the coupling strength is 1/n+ in the. In all the models that they look for non-Gaussianity, they have couplings that are usually suppressed by much, like 1/λ.
Lambda is typically.
Yeah. Well, lambda is typically like 100 times Hubble, the Hubble scale. So it's not in Planck. It's like.
It's not far from M-Planck, right?
Well, I mean, it's a different. If you have 10 to the 14, Wien's lambda is 10 to the 16. It's different from M-Planck, which is 10 to the 18, and couples were gradually. So we're talking about. I can easily imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, but even for this, they have to be, like, the cutoff cannot be much above that. So it's a funny. I don't know. I mean, it could be small, because if you just assume that the regime you want to be in. But in the early times, it could be important, so you could have effects in large modes.
Which, are the ones you can look at anyway, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, of course, if phi gets too close to M Planck,
yeah.
Then you get, non-Gaussianity, because that's when you get back reaction. So,
Yeah,
then of course, you would expect. The question, I guess, is how close you need to get. I don't know what the limits are on kind of the couplings.
Yeah, it's not clear. could be that it doesn't have any effect, because as I said, usually these couplings are very small.
Yeah.
People usually assume much bigger couplings. Anyway, okay, thank you very much.
Yeah,
this was very nice and clear. Yeah, yeah, yeah.